Eightfold Path. We're at the eighth fold, and what's called right concentration. And to remember that the Eightfold Path is not what's necessarily just a good way of being, but it's particularly designed and defined as that which is right for, or that which is suitable or appropriate for, a path of liberation, of freedom. And so concentration is the last one. Concentration follows mindfulness, right mindfulness, which is the seventh. And it follows partly to indicate the necessity of developing sustained attention, sustained continuous awareness of what's happening in the present moment. And concentration is a very important part of Buddhist spirituality, about the very important part of a meditative path, meditative practice. And in thinking about this today, I feel that a lot of people, a lot of Vipassana students in the West, now have been practicing for many years, and many of them have a very good understanding and appreciation of mindfulness practice and what it is and how to apply it and how to the context for holding a mindfulness practice in their life and the value of it. And I was quite inspired last week to hear many of you share the value you found in it. And not reflecting anything that anyone said last week particularly, but just in general, my sense is that many American Vipassana students have a very good understanding of the practice, but the next level that would be, so would serve them well, the next level of practice would be to develop concentration, to yoke or connect that mindfulness with concentration, with the real sustained continuity of attention, of mindfulness. So to couple that understanding with continuity. Also, some people I've noticed, probably all of us at some point or other, confuse understanding with deep liberating insight, or confuse understanding with wisdom. And what I mean by this is that understanding is a cognitive understanding. You can say, well, I understand this such and such a way. I have this other kind of understanding. One of the primary understandings that we develop through Buddhist practice is the understanding of impermanence. And it's very easy to have an intellectual understanding of impermanence and believe in it and it makes good sense and all that. But there's a big difference between understanding impermanence and understanding it very deeply, but just mostly just intellectually, versus very deep insight, very deep penetrating insight into the moment-to-moment arising and passing phenomena. We actually see impermanence. The seeing, the deep penetrating seeing, is very different than any kind of understanding, however right the understanding might be. So we tend to, at some point or other, many of us tend to confuse some understanding, because it's a new understanding, it's a liberating understanding to some degree, we see the world, we understand the world in a new way, and it seems right, whatever. And so it's very subtle, it's deeper than maybe a normal belief system, but it's still just an understanding. And the function of mindfulness practice is actually to understand life much deeper than any level of understanding, but to drop down into a kind of penetrating insight itself. And that's some place where there's some confusion sometimes. And mindfulness is not just simply a matter... Mindfulness, the opportunity of mindfulness practice is more than just coping better with our life. The opportunity of mindfulness is also to develop a deep insight, deep penetrating liberation within our life itself, to have a radical shift of identity within ourselves, within our experience of life, within our participation with the world around us. And for that, it's very helpful to have concentration, to have concentrated attention. The opposite of concentration, perhaps, is distracted attention, or divided attention. And as I've said before, many of us find ourselves distracted from our distractions by our distractions. We're so distracted we don't know it because the distractions are distracting us. And many of us find ourselves that way. And it's a common expression to have our attention divided, divided attention, to have our attention scattered, to be preoccupied by multiple of different phenomena, different things. And it's easy when we're when we're scattered in our attention, many things want our attention, or we are fixated on many different things, it's easy to both become overly excited, to have too much energy, and then to get overly fatigued because of it. It's also easy to end up being inattentive when the attention is scattered in too many different places, to become restless and bored. So I read this, I mentioned this on Saturday, but I thought this was the great newspaper article of the week. It's titled Looking Good. Cellular phones are a big status symbol in Chile. But when Santiago police stopped 49 motorists for using them while driving in a wealthy suburb, they found that about a third of the phones were fake. The point is, after all, to look important. Editors of the local paper that carried the story said they did not know whether the fine for using a fake phone is lower than for using a real one. It should be. One-way dialogue is less distracting. So the editor seemed to think that one-way dialogue is less distracting. But I wonder, you know... And then, you know, the people who are really talking to someone on the phone are doing two things at once, supposedly. They're talking on the phone and driving a car. But someone who's talking on their phone, but it's a fake phone, they're both driving and talking and making something up and involved in the whole status thing. So they're really kind of involved in many different activities at once. And if we do too much of this, I think actually we might look important, but I think it's tiring. So I wanted to read this story. I've read it before, but it's a nice story. A young man who had a bitter disappointment in life went to a remote monastery and said to the abbot, "I am disillusioned with life and wish to attain enlightenment to be freed from these sufferings. But I have no capacity for sticking long at anything. I could never do long years of meditation and study and austerity. I should relapse and be drawn back to the world again, painful though I know it to be. Is there any short way for people like me?" Is it a common concern? "There is," said the abbot. Maybe I should stop now. "If you are really determined, tell me, what have you studied? What have you concentrated on most in your life?" "Why, nothing really. We were rich, and I did not have to work. I suppose the thing I was really interested in was chess. I spent most of my time at that." The abbot thought for a moment, and then said to his attendant, "Call such and such a monk, and tell him to bring a chessboard and men." The monk came with a board, and the abbot set up the pieces. He went for a sword and showed it to the two. "O monk," he said, "you have vowed obedience to me as your abbot, and now I require it of you. You will play a game of chess with this youth, and if you lose, I will cut off your head with a sword. But I promise that you will be reborn in paradise. If you win, I shall cut off the head of this man. Chess is the only thing he has ever tried hard at, and if he loses, he deserves to lose his head also." They looked at the abbot's face and saw that he meant it. He would cut off the head of the loser. They began to play. With the opening moves, the youth felt the sweat trickling down to his heels as he played for his life. The chessboard became the whole world. He was entirely concentrated on it. At first, he had somewhat the worst of it, but then the other made an inferior move, and he seized his chance to launch a strong attack. As his opponent's position crumbled, he looked covertly at him. He saw a face of intelligence and sincerity, worn with years of austerity and effort. He thought of his own worthless life, and a wave of compassion came over him. He deliberately made a blunder, and then another blunder, ruining his position and leaving himself defenseless. The abbot suddenly leapt forward and upset the board. The two contestants sat stupefied. "There is no winner and no loser," said the abbot slowly. "There is no head to fall here. Only two things are required." And he turned to the young man. "Complete concentration and compassion. You have today learned them both. You were completely concentrated on the game, but then in that concentration, you could feel compassion and sacrifice your life for it. Now stay here a few months and pursue our training in this spirit, and your enlightenment is sure." He did so and got it. So concentration and compassion, and maybe the implication in the abbot's word is that compassion comes with concentration, which I believe is the case. But also, I like this story because I think of the two coming together in a spiritual life. You need both compassion and concentration. And if you try to develop concentration without a tremendous sense of compassion, acceptance, and trust in life, and okayness with life, then you might get into deep trouble with your meditation practice. A lot of people in meditative world pursue concentration as a be-all and end-all of spiritual practice, or get, and they end up sometimes having very distorted practices because they strive a lot. They're sometimes competitive. They get ambitious. They get very disappointed and hurt when they don't get concentrated. They measure their success as a person, as a spiritual student, by the level of concentration. They might succeed in getting concentrated, and then they get inflated and arrogant. Concentration has a lot of problems in Buddhist circles. I don't talk about it too much. However, it is a very important element, so I'm talking about it tonight. So we hold it together with compassion, together with acceptance, understanding, maybe some humility even, without the sense of a goal orientation that we have to get something from it. But without some degree of continuity of attention, of sustained, penetrating concentration, it's all too easy to be kind of floating on the surface of our life, to be floating in the surface chatter of the mind, and not really to connect deeply with our life and deeply with ourselves and deeply with our friends around us. And part of the function of concentration is to give mindfulness some strength. It gives mindfulness a real chance to really connect fully with what's here now. And the analogy which I like to use is the analogy of shaking hands with someone. That in some kind of superficial cocktail party kind of scenes, you might go and shake someone's hand, and before you know it, before you almost even touch hands, they're already looking towards someone else, and all you get is this limp kind of, you know, unpresent hand. And then we know what it's like to shake someone's hand when they're really present for us. They're really there, and there's a firm, connected handshake and a real presence there. And what we're asking to do in mindfulness is not to kind of be present in a kind of dismissive way or quick way or casual way, but really to bring full presence to what we're paying attention to, with the full presence that you bring to a friend, that you're going to shake their hand and really be there for them in a full and honest and direct way. But to do that with compassion, acceptance, wisdom. In other words, to be with our experience, to be with ourselves without the conflict. A lot of what mindfulness practice is about is finding experience of ourselves and of our experience and being in the world that is without conflict, without a conflict of being overly ambitious or greedy or full of hate or aversion or confusion, but rather to find some simple way of being, peaceful way of being. And one of the synonyms for concentration sometimes in Buddhism is calm and sometimes peacefulness. And which is going to be without conflict. And I think all of us have the experience that we can understand our life much better. We can understand real conflict in our situation, real kind of problems we have to kind of solve and deal with in our life, which not by dismissing them, but not by getting so calm that we kind of don't care, but having enough calmness, enough peacefulness, and enough presence so we can look at it clearly. And so out of clear seeing, and that of perhaps some intuitive, deeper wisdom that's allowed to surface because of that calmness, some wiser decision might arise. So to live a life, to have some opportunities in our life to become concentrated, calm, and concentrated is very, very important. It's said in Buddhism that concentration is supported by positive emotion, by kind of wholesome emotions, like, for example, joy. Joy is considered to be, in some of the famous lists of how meditative practice progresses, it's said that joy needs to arise before concentration, or healthy concentration can arise. That if we're in conflict with ourselves, or don't like ourselves, and we're trying to get concentrated to get rid of something or prove ourselves, it's very difficult. It's possible to get concentrated, but it might not be wise concentration. And that wise concentration is built on contentment, built on joy, maybe happiness, built on steadiness or stability in the present moment. It's possible to get concentrated because of fear, or out of desperation, or out of ambition. And I've known people who've gotten tremendously concentrated based on those kinds of motivation. And I haven't seen that it's been useful for them. There's a quote that I came across recently by the Buddha. I don't know if I completely agree with it, but it brings a lot of truth to me. And that is, the mind of someone who suffers is distracted, is not concentrated. That if a person's suffering, that there's many things going on besides lack of concentration, for sure, but the mind is not concentrated. And it's true that a mind that is deeply concentrated will be deeply contented with life, deeply... maybe it's enough to say that. Other things can come also, like joy and happiness and equanimity. But a deeply concentrated mind is certainly contented.
Can I ask a question? Do you start with being concentrated, or do you start with being contented and then you're concentrated?
It's a good question. Is it a chicken or the egg kind of question? And different teachers have different answers to that. Some teachers actually will teach concentration first. But a lot of what happens in starting off the concentration is people struggle with themselves and with their effort and all their conflicts and everything until all that kind of eventually kind of settles down enough. And then the concentration kind of begins to roll on its own.
Maybe they run into one another.
They roll in, and they're not separate. These things like concentration and mindfulness and compassion are not independent of each other. It's really a matter of emphasis. And some techniques, some practices, and some teachers will emphasize, for example, mindfulness much more than concentration, some concentration much more than mindfulness. But every time you do a concentration practice, you need to have some modicum of mindfulness, so you can't do it. And every time you do a mindfulness practice, you need to have some modicum of concentration. And so they go together, but it's a matter of emphasis. In our tradition, we tend to emphasize mindfulness over concentration. And the concentration that usually will come by itself if we're very diligent with the mindfulness. But sometimes... and that's one of the reasons we don't talk a lot about concentration.
Does concentration have to do with motivation?
Lots to do. It can, yes. And I'll talk about that in a moment. So the question then is, you know, how to get concentrated? You know, what's the way to get concentrated? And so I'll talk about that a little bit, at least, you know, one way of approaching it from the point of view of mindfulness practice that we do. And I like to think of it as developing concentration from the ground up. From the ground up means really from where we're at right now, rather than developing a mental focus on some, you know, trying to get someplace that we're not. So what does it mean to get concentrated from the ground up, from where we are? Not using meditation or awareness or as a technique, but rather to infuse our presence, our mindfulness, with wisdom, compassion, acceptance of our present moment as it is. So one of the words that is closely connected to concentration is the word concentric circles. And maybe it's a nice way of thinking of it, there's all these concentric circles to our life. And mindfulness, we start and pay attention to the widest concentric circle that's obvious to us in the present moment. And then we kind of, as we attend to the widest circle, then we naturally kind of find ourselves coming closer and closer. The concentric circles get narrower and smaller until finally we find ourselves in the center. One of the dictionary definitions of concentration is to bring things together. To concentrate is to bring things together. And I like that because sometimes we think concentration is to focus the mind and the attention on one thing, a single point of concentration, we say. But another way of seeing concentration is rather it's bringing our whole being, our whole life, our body, our mind, our intention, our motivation, our thoughts, bring it all together so it's not scattered or divided, so it's all in one place doing one thing. And so sometimes we talk about the unification of mind and body, the unification of the heart, as a synonym for concentration. So you start with the widest concentric circle. And that is simply to, very directly and simply, to recognize what is happening right now. And there's nothing magical about that. There's nothing like we have to get to some wonderful spiritual state. Something's always happening. And what mindfulness is asking us to do is to recognize what's happening right now. To recognize that, and then to have some kind of acceptance of that present reality. Acceptance doesn't mean condoning it, but it means simply seeing it clearly, allowing it to be there clearly, with clear presence, without any movement of trying to push it away or denying it, or criticizing it, or holding on to it, or justifying it, or whatever we try to do. So to have this neutral, balanced experience, oh, this is what it is, to see it clearly. So we take the widest. You know, what is the widest thing that's happening to you right now? You see, what is it happening to you? You just recognize that. You know, you're sitting here, and maybe you're thinking about tomorrow. You've lost interest in what I'm saying, or maybe you're more interested in tomorrow and planning the day, and your mind is wandering away, or you're thinking about a conversation you had earlier today, or you're thinking about something I said 5 minutes ago, and you're analyzing it or criticizing me for it, or thinking that was really great, or whatever. Or you're kind of wondering where I'm trying to go with this now, you know, and your thoughts are kind of in, you know, there's some, you know, you're uncomfortable in your body, and you're kind of like, you know, oh, this is getting too much, and, you know, and I wish I hadn't sat on the floor, now I can't really move, because maybe, you know, he's already started talking, the guy, and maybe if he blinks, I can quickly go to the chair. And you know, so to recognize where you're actually at, and not to criticize or judge, but simply this is what's happening. It's the miracle of life, the awe, the miracle of just being alive. Is recognize the miracle. This is what's happening. You're having these kinds of thoughts. This is what's going on in your body. And this is what's happening. So to recognize what's happening, that's where we start, the widest concentric circle. And then the next smaller concentric circle is then the bringing together. Bringing together into a kind of single point, or just simply bringing together into a unified whole. And what this means is to have our body, our mind, and our motivation, our intention, all in one place, all kind of centered on one thing. And it's easy to have the three of them in three different places. If you're sitting here meditating and thinking about tomorrow, your body is one place and your mind is someplace else. Or if you're trying to follow your breath, but really what you really want to do is to solve some problem that you have at work. And so your mind keeps going off. You know, your life intention is more solving this problem. And your casual intention is to be with the breath. Your intention is really somewhere else, and you're split. And your body might be here, or your body might be, you know, hungry, and its body's thinking about food. So it's easy enough to have all these things, these three different parts of our life, split from each other in various ways. And what we try to do in mindfulness is to have our body, our mind, and our intention, our motivation, all unified together in the same thing, without any violence to ourselves, without being in conflict with ourselves. And what that means, part of the art of mindfulness, is then recognizing what is really happening, the first wider concentric circle, and then seeing that, deciding where our attention really should be. So, for example, it could be you're sitting here meditating, and you're trying to follow your breath. But really what's happening, you're full of anger about something that happened today. And you're thinking about, you know, what happened, going through a story. And to unify yourself in that moment isn't try to bring everything back on the breath, and kind of force it beyond the anger. Rather, you unify yourself on the anger. You feel the experience of anger in your body, you feel the, in your heart, you experience what it's like in your mind, and you let your intention to pay attention, to come together on this experience of anger, to see if you can accept it in the same way that I talked about earlier, not to push it away, or not to hold on to it, not to fuel it or justify it, but simply to see it, this is what's going on. And it's a lot easier to arrive in the present moment if you can bring all those things together for what's predominant in the present moment. And to recognize what it might really be if it isn't the breath, if it isn't just simply kind of the normal meditative practice that we have. So if you have an itch, for example, if you have pain in your body, as you all know, we let go of the pain, we let go of the breath, and we bring the mind, the body, and the intention all to bear on this itch or on this physical experience. And then we're not in conflict, and we kind of, this unification begins happening, this coming together of our experience. That way we're not at cross purposes with each other, with ourselves. It's to arrive, in a sense, to arrive here with a full bodily sense, to be embodied, to bring the mind, to rest the mind in this body, right here. I like to say again, to develop concentration from the ground up. So to be here, in your experience that you're having right now. So to be embodied, to enter the body. So you feel yourself sitting here, you know, in your chair or on the cushion, feeling the weight against the ground, and feeling yourself supported by the chair or the ground, your cushion, and feel the experience of being present, of arriving and being, this is the place I'm at. And here I am, and in this place of being here and having arrived, I am now wondering, you know, about when is this guy ever going to stop talking? Or this is very interesting. Or, you know, I'm getting kind of uncomfortable sitting here, and it's kind of restless. And, you know, you're having all kinds of reactions and feeling experiences, but have those within this experience of a settled body, within this body, what's actually happening here? And to feel it from the inside out, rather than the outside in, which I would define now as being just kind of in the world of your thoughts and your ideas, swimming around and having a ping pong ball of thoughts, you know, going around thinking this and thinking that, and, you know, but to experience as a holistic experience, a unified experience of mind, body, and intention. Or you're listening to me speak, because that's what I'm doing. And so now you're simply listening to me with your ideas and having my ideas bounce off with your ideas and, you know, whatever you do in there in the brain. But to listen with the whole bodily experience. So your whole body is present. So you're sitting here and you're listening maybe with not just the ears listening, but your whole body is listening to the words. And so mind and body and intention are here together. When the body and the mind and the intention can all be more or less together, there's a dividing, a meditator comes to a dividing fork, a fork in the road. And it's possible to take two different routes in meditative life. One is in the direction of increased concentration, which sometimes is described as increased expansiveness. Sometimes people call it an expansiveness of self, developing a very expansive sense of self. And it can be very blissful, full of joy and happiness, to enter into deep states of concentration. The other route, which is the route of mindfulness, is to use that unified attention, to use that unified sense of presence, not to develop a greater expansive sense of self, a greater sense of joy that penetrates out into all corners of the universe, but rather to use it to begin seeing directly the nature of our experience of life. Because if we get too expansive, it's very wonderful to have a very expansive sense of self, an expansive sense of joy. But the expansive sense that comes from concentration practice always comes with is always conceptual at some level. And I don't want to go into the definition of that. Mindfulness is to see beyond concept, to see the transparency of concepts. And you don't see the transparency of concepts very well when the mind is lost in a transcendental concept of cosmic joy or unity or bliss. So we take the route of wisdom, of seeing deeply. So when we have some modicum of bringing the body and the mind and the intention together into the experience, then what we want to do is sustain the attention on what we're paying attention to. So we bring our attention to something, we connect it to something, and then we want to develop some sustainability, some sustaining of attention on one object, on one thing. often that's the breath. And so we try to sustain our attention so we have a continuity of being with a full cycle of breath. From the beginning of the in-breath to the end, from the beginning of the out-breath to the end of the out-breath. So it sustains itself over a series of breaths. So the mind doesn't wander away. If it wanders away, it just barely wanders away. And you're right there, you come back right away. And you stay there with the breath, developing concentration in the breathing. Honing some sense of concentration gets sharper and sharper on this one thing. Recognizing when something else arises that's predominant, to let go of the breath and then hone the concentration, the attention on whatever else is predominant. So to be here, sitting here, and to experience yourself in your body, to be resting here in your body, listening perhaps to me speaking with your whole body, having your attention alert to what's happening, to wanting to listen, or perhaps if you're not interested, or you have other concerns that you would do, to bring your body and mind and intention into those other concerns and to experience those and feel them. What is it like to have that kind of sustained attention? To rest the attention, not to force it, not to be in conflict, not to struggle, but to let go and be open. To kind of yield yourself to what you're paying attention to so you can open and receive it more fully in a sustained way. And that's kind of the third smaller concentric circle. And to do that, then we can kind of then the concentration becomes even more narrow, kind of more narrow, closer to the center even, and the concentration can get very, very sharp, and it becomes very penetrating. You don't just simply sustain your attention on one thing, but you begin seeing very deeply through it. You see a transparency of it. You see very, very deeply the nature of that experience itself, what it actually makes up, the way in which we experience that, or the way in which we relate to it. Very, very deep levels of concentration. So you're listening here to me speaking, and you're really present, and you're here, and you feel maybe a whole body listening, and you hear the words coming out of my mouth, and they come into your ear, and they're like notes of music that arise and they pass, and you understand what I'm saying, but also you hear just sound that arises and passes, and when I finish one word, it's gone forever, and it's gone, and kind of where has it gone, and what has happened to it in your mind? Does it linger there? Have you held on to it? Are you resisting it? Are you in conflict with it? Are you doing something with it? Or is it simply, once the word has been spoken, has it simply vanished? And you see the transparency of concepts of words. Then you can maybe see that there's a choice in how we relate to it. And we can start seeing maybe how we have a choice, or we have a responsibility, or we have freedom that's possible in how we choose to relate to the concepts and the words that might arise in our mind, in our thoughts, in the world around us. And you might be in disagreement still, you might not, but you also see those just sounds that arise and that pass away, like the birds singing outside or whatever. It's all transparent. And they have an experience of how it transparently passes through the field of awareness is part of the function of very deep concentration. To see through the concepts themselves, to see the transparency of concepts, and to find some sense of self, to find some sense of wholeness, of some sense of presence of life itself, that doesn't reference itself, doesn't center itself in the world of concepts themselves. Because so many of us find ourselves where we swim and live and drown in this world of thoughts and ideas and concepts, and everything relates to concepts and ideas here and there. And they're wonderful and they're fine, except when we're kind of lost in them entirely. And we can kind of surrender or yield or relax or penetrate or see there's much more to life than ideas. Ideas are just like musical notes that arise and they pass. And there's silence, for example, that holds the notes. Or there's much more that's going on. So to develop concentration. So it comes with mindfulness. It comes with sustained practice of bringing mindfulness to whatever we're experiencing. I say that because it's true, but I say that because you don't get too caught up with trying to develop concentration as the goal. It's best, I think, to develop concentration almost as a byproduct of sustained, careful attention into the present moment. And it comes. So if you go on retreat, for example, if you simply follow the schedule, keep the silence, and just kind of follow it in a steady, kind of simple way, the concentration will naturally find you. You don't have to huff and puff and try to get concentrated. And it's really marvelous to do that. And it's a great joy. It's one of the great joys of life, is to have a concentrated mind or a concentrated body. I don't say that as, you know, to say that's better than other things. I just say it because it's true. It's one of the great joys. I'm not saying it's supposed to happen or it should happen to you. I don't have an easy time getting concentrated, actually. I mean, sometimes people think that I have an easy time concentrating because I'm a meditation teacher and I get to talk about all this all the time. But I don't, you know, it's not easy for me to develop concentration. It's not necessarily what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to be mindful. But with sustained effort and attention, I can get concentrated. And one of the things that's helped me a lot to get concentrated has been going on long retreats. Some of the deepest experiences of concentration and of penetrating insight that I've had has come from going on long retreats, where the whole environment of the retreat is really supportive for allowing a person to develop concentration and develop it and sustain it and keep it going without any interruption, so that these concentric circles become, you know, you're bringing all together, bring everything together, and it gets kind of more and more unified and centered and maybe focused. It's so concentration. It's great. We don't need a lot of concentration. It isn't like, you know, this huge amount of concentration that we need. We all have the ability within us. I like to say that the amount of concentration we need to meditate is the amount of concentration we need to take the written exam at the DMV. And I think most people, you know, I don't know most, I don't know, I can't say for a lot of people, but I think there's a fair amount of concentration that there are. You know, you're present, and or maybe the driving exam. You're really present. The guy's sitting there, and it's really important. And you're not thinking about tomorrow, or you know, what you're going to cook, or what you're going to buy, or anything. You're really there for that experience of driving with this guy who's giving you a grade. I used to love when I was in college. I used to love taking exams, not because I was good at taking the exams, but because I would get concentrated. I didn't know why, but at the time, it wasn't until I started meditating I realized why I enjoyed them so much. But I would show up for my calculus exam, my chemistry exam, and I would do it. And by the time I left the exam, I'd just go outside and I'd be in awe. I'd just be so still and so calm and so empty, and I'd just walk around kind of like stoned. 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 And it certainly wasn't the chemistry, but it was the concentration with which I was, you know, doing the exam. I had an hour to do this test, and this is all I was doing. And the last thing I'll say, I feel it's very inadequate. There's a lot more to be said about concentration, but the last thing I'll say is that if you have enough presence of mind, enough attention to criticize how your meditation practice is going, then you have all the presence of mind that you need to be doing it right, to doing it. You have plenty. If you can judge your meditation as not being successful enough, you have enough presence of mind to be doing it successfully. Isn't that a wonderful paradox? So there's never an excuse for criticizing yourself for doing it wrong, for being poor at it. It just, you have enough presence to recognize what's happening now, and to find some way of being at peace with it, or to be with it, and hold it in a wide container, hold it really widely or spaciously or generously. So maybe we can take a couple of questions or comments. Bill.
I fail to understand the difference between staying in the present moment and being concentrated. There are inherently one and the same, why they're not. If you have the presence of mind to stay in the present moment, then you're concentrated automatically.
There are two different kinds of concentration. There is a kind of concentration that's simply the concentration to be in the present moment, which is called momentary concentration. You're just present for whatever's arising in the present moment. And to do that well requires a strong degree of concentration. But it's a different kind of concentration than what's called one-pointed concentration, where you're simply focusing on one particular thing and your mind is unwavering from that one particular thing. So in the first one, you hear sounds, and you have an itch, and you have a pain, and someone coughs, and you feel your breath, and you're very much in the present moment, but you're kind of flowing along with all the different things that are kind of happening in the present moment. And your mind's not wandering into the future, it's not getting distracted or thinking about anything else, but it's really in the present moment, but it's flowing with the change of the present moment. Someone honks the horn outside and you hear it. Then your knee kind of suddenly hurts and you really feel the knee. And then you have a memory and you know that you're having a memory. And then you go back to your breath and you're there with the breath because it's predominant. One point of concentration is you decide to stay on the breath and you don't waver. The attention absolutely will not leave that breath no matter what. If there's sound outside, the primary focus of your attention is really on that breath, and you hardly hear the sound. You might not hear the sound at all. And one point of concentration sometimes is called exclusionary awareness, because you exclude all these other things from awareness besides this one single point.
That's true even if you move from thing to thing, because that's what's happening then.
Yes, but you're not the one who's in control. In one point of concentration, you're controlling, saying, this is what I'm going to do no matter what. In momentary concentration, which flows, you've made the intention to stay in the present moment and then to kind of give up control and allow the present moment to reveal itself to you. And you're kind of open to the change, allowing the change to happen in an accepting and allowing way. And it isn't that you're completely casual, you really connect fully with what's happening in the present moment, but you're not holding on to it or being or pushing anything else out that might arise and become stronger. So if you're concentrating one-pointedly on the breath, even if your knee hurts very, very strongly, you're not going to go to the knee and pay attention to it. You're going to stay with the breath. So we can talk more about it some other time. Yes?
You mentioned expansive states and how, I don't remember exactly how you said it, but something that they don't go with total concentration because this concept involves.
There's two different routes for concentration at certain point. When there's a certain level of unified experience, we can either take the one point of concentration route or the momentary concentration route, which is the mindfulness route. And the one point of concentration route, it'll bring a very expansive sense states of self, they sometimes say, or very expansive states of joy, of bliss, of rapture, of equanimity, of great feelings of space or infinite feelings of consciousness, quite amazing states. But the way that the Buddhists understand this, these are still conceptual. And they're kind of, especially the ones of joy and of rapture and equanimity. And so they're wonderful and they're very healing and they definitely have their usefulness and their dangers. However, because the concentration is so intensely focused on one thing, the mind doesn't have the ability to penetratively see and understand what's really going on. And so that part, I'm thinking of, you know, these things you have on the horses,
blinders.
And so the horse sees directly in front of it really well, but it doesn't have enough sense to realize where it is, because it can't see the whole environment.
So if you are in one of those expansive states via mindfulness,
yes,
as opposed to focused concentration, then that's different.
It's different. And a lot of the experiences, the joy and the rapture and the expansiveness and equanimity that comes with one point of concentration can be experienced in mindfulness practice, but it tends to be at a milder level. Mm-hmm. It tends not to be as intense. But it's very comparable, but we just continue doing the mindfulness within that. And when mindfulness on retreats, when mindfulness becomes very very strong with very strong concentration, there is at times a kind of similar experience of exclusionary presence. You're not really so aware of things around you, and sometimes the body will disappear. You no longer feel like you have a body. Sometimes you don't experience the room, you don't hear sounds. So these things aren't so radically distinct at times. But it's a matter again of the balance between mindfulness and concentration, perhaps. And with mindfulness, the mindful awareness of presence, the presence of mind, recognizing what's happening in the present moment, stays present, and continues even in those states. It's very interesting that in Buddhism, in Buddhist maps of spiritual states, of meditative states, they have no places on that map for the kinds of altered states of consciousness within which there is no awareness of what's happening, no self-awareness. So, for example, in some perhaps shamanic states, there are definitely altered states and all kinds of things happen. Fascinating things happen. But the person going through it doesn't know it. And they might come out of that shamanic state sometimes, and they're told, oh, by the way, you noticed that, you know, you were doing this and that, and you said this and that, and, oh, I didn't know that. Those kinds of things are never even talked about, or hardly ever talked about in Buddhist manuals of meditative states or states of consciousness. I think because the Buddhists put so much emphasis on the importance of having some degree of awareness of what's happening in the present moment. And even in the one-pointed states of concentration, there remains some modicum of self-awareness of what's going on. So, what last one?
I have this tendency to take things too literally, but I really have a problem with the abbot and the story. Can you help me out? I mean, this is going to be
I take it to be, I prefer to take the story to be a myth. And myth, you know, he was going to metaphorically chop off their head. To metaphorically, you know, do something or other. You can maybe a little bit more participate in a sense of intensity that that person was practicing with when he's playing chess. And it isn't that we have to have that kind of intensity, we're sweating, we're meditating. But there is a kind of a certain kind of real, I don't want to use the word intense, but a total dedication that comes with practice at times, and to be able to recognize and know when it's appropriate to do that, and to get a taste or flavor of that from the story is kind of maybe the idea. So maybe a modern version of it would be, you know, what would be your version? What could the abbot take away from you that would get your attention really focused in that chess game?
I guess the whole thing is I don't like the idea of a threat.
Okay.
And the abuse of trust and power. That's what I have.
Oh, I see. I see.
Having an abbot, a spiritual leader, and it's betrayal.
Great. Well. I think that's great. I think it's wonderful. I think it's wonderful there are people in our sangha who are sensitive to those kinds of issues. It's very, very important. And I hope that. That the spiritual teachers you come into contact with never try to pull something never try to pull something like that on you.
It's monitoring with fear. That
isn't
right.
It isn't. However, I want to share your concerns, and I share very much the problems of the abuse of authority that goes on. And there's been too many abuses for us to be casual about it. However, I just want to also say there is a place for authority, and but not authority that's taken without permission. But when there's kind of a sense of permission, kind of a sense of agreement and understanding between a student and a teacher, then there are times that it's appropriate for the teacher to kind of actually take a position of authority, and actually at times even like. In ways that sometimes on the outside look like they're being like an extremely strict parent and coming down very strongly on the student. And it isn't abusive. It can, but sometimes it is. So it can be.
Do you have that experience in your training?
Oh, I've had that with some of my teachers. Very strict teachers. And I could have, you know, I could have always left. You know, I didn't feel like, you know, I didn't feel like I gave up my personal responsibility. I didn't feel like I gave up my choice or my options. I had enough sense of my own experience, how I was reacting and relating to take responsibility for what was going on. But this guy was really stern and tough. And he was, you know, playing out that game of being a tough, stern, you know, kind of like Zen master kind of guy. And he got my attention. And, you know, and I didn't fool around. I wasn't going to fool around, you know. If I was going to fool around, I would have left. You know, and I was very grateful for that he was playing that game, because, you know, I bought into it enough that it was useful for me and actually helped kind of propel me along. For other people who played this, who was with him, that game was harmful for them. And he didn't have enough wisdom to notice when it was useful for students and when it was harmful. And some other people I've known have gone and talked to him about this, and he doesn't, you know, talked about this problem with him, and he doesn't seem to understand. So I've had that experience beneficially, and I've seen it detrimentally. I've had teachers do things to me, similar things to me. I didn't know whether it was harmful, you know, healthy or unhealthy, kind of what they were doing. But either way, I didn't do it. I just you know, let go of it, and you know, and didn't do it the what they wanted me to do. No, I think, you know, as me, from personally as a teacher, I tend to be more on the side of kind of not wanting to take authority. I mean, very careful not to do that and let people take responsibility for themselves and to kind of, if you know, mostly listen carefully to what the student wants and then kind of meet them and encourage them and stuff like that. But there have been a few times where very gently I've been somewhat strict with someone. I felt and sensed that there was permission, basically, and it was very appropriate to say to this person, look, you, I want you to sit and walk during this retreat. I want you to be in that hall and sitting. I don't want you kind of wandering around, taking a bath or having tea. You should be in there, and I want you to be walking, and that's what you're supposed to be doing now. And the person was grateful for that. And it would have been, I think, it would be a great loss if we didn't have teachers who knew when wisely to do things like that with their students. So it's a whole big mixed bag. So it's very good to have students who are sensitive to these issues like you are, because then it's easier for the teachers to work with students, because you know, it's they can all talk. See, the danger is when you have a teacher where you can't talk about what's going on. So like when I've done this, you know, it's not a big deal to say, you know, you show up every time for the sitting. I'm not like I'm chopping off their head. but you know, that person could have said, you know, come back and say, why did you tell me that? Or I disagree, or I don't feel like it. And then we could have had a very responsible, intelligent conversation about all this, and everything's out in the open, out in the front. What I really love about mindfulness practice is mindfulness practice itself is a powerful teacher, and I trust the mindfulness practice so much that it's enough just to encourage people to be mindful, and what they need to learn will come in its own good time. And sometimes I see students, I say, well, you know, if I just pointed it out to them, you know, it would be so much helpful, or I should just kind of, you know, have a little bit of discipline there or whatever. And after all, I have a Zen training, you know. But, you know, I trust the mindfulness practice, and I think there's a lot of benefit from people learning by themselves and figuring it out on their own and working with the difficulties of their own stuff and working with that. So it's nice just not to be too involved. And the kind of hands-off kind of approach. I'll end with one story. Maybe it's a horrifying story. And I don't know. I think it's okay. I think it's public enough. One of my main Zen teachers is now former abbot. He's retired from the San Francisco Zen Center, but he's the abbot of the Berkeley Zen Center, Mel Weissman. And Mel, if any of you have met him, he's a totally sweet, lovable man, very kind, very generous, very peaceful. Basically, not exactly humble, but totally ordinary, unpretentious. Appreciates and enjoys the everyday life as it is, and that's what he teaches. You know, just be yourself, and the fulfillment of Zen practice is just to be yourself. And he's totally himself. You can see him in the supermarket. He's just, you know, no one special, but there's something really special about that. Nothing specialness about him. Totally wonderful, sweet man. And he had a student where he said and asked him, you know, in the context of many, many years of very close working relationship together and great trust and familiarity and knowing each other really well. He said, you know, show me, express to me or show me your true nature, which is something a Zen teacher might do. It's a wonderful kind of koan, a question, you know, what is your true nature? And come and express it to me, show it to me. And this student then immediately stopped going to the Zendo to meditate, I'm not quite sure exactly the story, so it's kind of, now it's getting kind of hazy. But you know, he started acting. He kind of started acting out. He stopped going to the zendo. He stopped showering and shaving. He stopped. You know, he started eating and drinking and all this stuff. And for a week, he just kind of was this complete slob and kind of. And then after this week of being completely stinking and beer and everything, he kind of showed up for his interview with his Zen master and said, "This is my true nature." And Mel slugged him. I have no idea how hard it was, a light tap, you know, or you know, whatever. I've had Zen masters, you know, hit me with their stick, you know, and it's like this, you know. You know, they're play acting, you know, and if there's, you know, in the real world of Chinese Zen, they would have been, you know, but they were kind of like making a point, you know. So I don't know how much he slugged him, but you know, and I don't know if that was, you know, the student one who told me this, and he said he got something. He really appreciated that. He needed to get that. He was acting out. He was doing all this weird behavior, and somehow or other, in that little story, he learned something that he wouldn't learn otherwise. So it had to do with a particular context. And a lot of these stories that you hear in Zen masters who kind of hit their students, it's a very, very particular context. And you have to, I think, give somehow the benefit of the doubt to the ancient context, that somehow in that context, in the relationship between those two people, that somehow or other that was appropriate. But again, your concern is very real, and we've had all too many problems of abuse of power and authority by teachers in the West. And if we don't keep our attention alert to always to the potential for abuse, it's easy enough even to abuse the authority as a teacher when you have even the best intentions as a teacher. And I think it's happened to me at times where I have responded in ways with all the compassion and care, you know, that I could have, but afterwards I thought, you know, I didn't really respond to meeting that person as they were, and probably what I said was not helpful, but rather was hurtful. And partly because I was in a position of authority, and so there was more trust given to what I was saying than would it be if, you know, we just met on the street. So we have to be attentive to that, and we have to also, in some sense, allow for that, because if we don't criticize our teachers when they do it wrong, we don't speak up when they do it, even when they do it with the best intention, we don't speak up and let them know so they can be in dialogue and even help them. We don't want to isolate our teachers. And our teachers are all fallible. And every single one of them, I believe. And unless we feel it can be an interactive relationship where the student can come back and say, "Hey, wait a minute, I don't know if I agree with that, or that didn't feel right, or just I felt lousy with that. What was going on there? And can we talk about it?" I think it's very dangerous. So we need students and teachers all need to be attentive to all this. And I can't imagine myself ever slugging a student. But oh, I'll tell you one more story. It'll be quick. So in a Zen monastery, you do this thing, a ceremony, when there's all these steps to being a Zen priest. And first you get ordained, and the next real important step is you become what's called the head monk, Shuso, in a monastery. And you're kind of the senior priest, the senior training monk, and you're kind of supposed to be the role model. You're kind of your first foray into being a teacher. You kind of start giving lectures and stuff. And at the end of this time, it's usually 3 months when you have this role of being a senior monk, senior kind of student, to the role model for the community. You do the ceremony, Shuso ceremony, which sometimes in Zen is called, in Asia it's called Dharma combat. Where in America we call it Dharma dialogue. And the feeling of it here in America tends to be very different. The head student holds a fan in one hand and a staff in the other, a long staff. And all the students, when I did it, there were 70 students. And there's two who have to ask questions. They all ask a single question, a powerful question, you know, their core essential question they have about, life, about their spiritual practice, about Zen. And they kind of send it out. The head monk sits there and says, kind of hits the stick against the floor really loudly. Bang! And says, next! Something. And then the person says, Shuso! They kind of yell it out in Zen spirit, Shuso! And then you're supposed to say, yes! And then they say, what is Buddha? And then you kind of say, you're supposed to answer them, meet them. You're supposed to just give them some kind of, flip answer. You're supposed to meet them, having known them for 3 months, you're supposed to meet them and really answer kind of very quickly and to the point, an answer that's really particular for them. But the spirit is more dialogue. But there's two categories of students who ask the questions. There's the students who are junior to you and the students who are senior to you who've done the ceremony before. And the ones who are junior to you, their instructions are, basically, this person's been your friend, and basically just ask a question out of your own practice, something you want to know, and this person will respond. But the people who are senior than you, for them it's Dharma combat. And they're there to test your mettle, really kind of test your understanding, really push you and try to show you where your understanding is kind of short, and really kind of, it's kind of really a test by fire, kind of really, it's kind of like, going for your orals in graduate school. So I did the ceremony, and there's like 70 people in this room, and 70 different questions. And if they're not satisfied with your answer, they ask another one. And it's kind of this give and take. My wife was in the audience, and she asked me, what is intimacy? Here? You want me to tell me here? So I kind of went around the room, and I was kind of a little tense at first. You can imagine. So I was going through the room, and by the time I got through half the room, I noticed I was switching over the second half of the room. I kind of relaxed. I realized it was basically going fine. And you're kind of in an altered state by the time you're kind of ritual and ceremony, and you're pretty hyped. It's like going. And so I was pretty, ready to really answer from this very concentrated, kind of deep kind of place. And it was great. I loved it. I guess it was supposed to be short. So, I had brought with me, in the robe of my sleeve of my robes, a flower. I think I had some idea it'd be useful. Like, a crib sheet, And so one of these people who are more senior than me started grilling me, asking me a question. And I said, come here. And it's a big deal because it's a very formal ceremony. Everybody's sitting down to get up and come up. It's kind of like a big deal. It's kind of like breaking the ritual almost. Like, come here. And so he said, I don't know what he said, but I said, come here. And he was afraid that if he came up there, that I was going to slug him. Or hit him. Because in Zen, there's a tradition, making your point. And he dropped it and said, no, thank you. And I passed. But, it's more my nature, I guess. I was actually going to give him the flower. As my answer. But no one ever knew. This is the first time I ever told anybody about this, flower that was under there.
You didn't give it to your wife.
I didn't ever. It didn't occur to me. Thank you.